During Jesus' trial, just prior to his crucifixion, the Roman prefect of Judea, Pontius Pilate, asked the Lord and maker of the heavens and earth, "What is truth?" One suspects that such a setup were the scene entirely the fabrication of an author who wished to wax eloquently on the subject of truth would include a lengthy treatise on the nature of truth as a follow-up answer to Pilate's question. But there is no follow-up. There are no words from Jesus, no lengthy sermon on the pavement about truth. Pilate simply goes back out to the crowd, which is demanding Jesus to be crucified, to tell them, quote, "I find no guilt in him," end quote. Pilate's question about truth is a good one. We are still talking about it 2,000 years later. Arguably, answering this particular question is the heart of what good philosophy and theology is all about. And part of what engenders the process of philosophical thinking, according to our guest again this week, professor of philosophy at Southern Evangelical Seminary, Dr. Richard G. Howe, is our basic everyday engagement with the physical world, from admiring and wondering about the sun, moon, and stars, to the colors of fur on our beloved pets. And this is precisely how the Bible encourages us to think, both through the things that God has created and through what He has revealed to us in Scripture, we can come to have a comprehensive understanding of what God is like. As we heard last week, philosophy is simply a love of wisdom, and the Bible is replete with wisdom literature. From the books of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes to the magisterial hymn to wisdom found in the 28th chapter of the book of Job, creation abounds with examples of wisdom, including exhortations such as this from the 6th chapter of Proverbs. Quote, "Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest." End quote. Whenever my kitchen counter is overrun with an ant trail and I subsequently wipe them out, this verse will often come to mind. I wonder if my insecticide isn't in part motivated by my conviction that the ants are in some way actually more wise than I am. I don't want to be reminded by ants of the fact that I fall short of the glory of God in a myriad of ways. But this is what creation is intended to do, to reveal God's invisible attributes to us. His wisdom, His care, His intelligence, His glory, His righteousness, and truth are clearly seen through what He has made, including the actions of ants, reminding me I'm not very wise. But I employ both philosophy and theology in making the connection between what ants do and what I don't do. In observing their behavior, there is wisdom to be found. But many today believe the Bible isn't a trustworthy source for wisdom. In our postmodern age, there has been a movement to relativize the Bible's history and interpretation. Can there be anything objectively true found in the pages of the Bible? Many scholars have told us no. And if that is indeed the case, can there really be anything objectively true about anything, especially in an age where it has become increasingly the norm that human beings believe they can alter their gender at will? To answer these and a host of other pressing questions of our time, Dr. Howe reminds us that we must recognize and recapture the importance of good philosophy and its relationship to our time-tested theological understanding of God as man, for man, in the person of Jesus. As we start part two, Dr. Howe shares with us a thought experiment about how our contemplation of nature engenders philosophical thinking. Here once again is Dr. Richard G. Howe.
You know, I found myself often in situations with friends of mine outside of my circles in scholarship and students as a seminary. Just with, friends that have real jobs, as my wife hates me to use that job, to use that expression, but they have real jobs. They're not in academics or whatever.
Right.
I find myself trying occasionally trying to lobby for things philosophical, some philosophical truth. Now, most of my friends already know that about me as an apologist and a philosopher, and most of them, in fact, I can't think of an exception, are already Christians. So that's not where the problem would lie. It was me trying to not only the principle of philosophy, as we've kind of been talking about dancing around as a legitimate enterprise, but really more specific philosophical truths that I would lobby to be. These are actually true. They're not just philosophical and, hey, that's pretty cool. They're philosophical, but they're also true. So what that led me to do, and I've only done this one time in a row, with my philosophy class that I teach at Southern Evangelical Seminary. I teach the philosophy for our apologetics track. Well, I teach myself that it's philosophy light, because we actually have a full-on MA in philosophy, uh-huh, and a PhD in philosophy of religion. I teach some of the PhD courses, but I'm really trying to teach it to people that this is their first exposure to it. So what I did once, I started it last year, was just a thought experiment. I won't go through the details for you, but just kind of give you the overall picture. It's a thought experiment of Aristotle out camping with his dog and just trying to see what it was that Aristotle observed around him that I think are normal observational experiences that normal people have, that if they identify the elements of what they see, hear, taste, touch, or smell, and label that, to say, oh yeah, I know what that is. You just make up a label, give it a name. Pretty soon you will reproduce a lot of the basic metaphysics of Aristotle. I'll give you maybe a few examples so we can make as many as you want. But I'll give you a few. So he's sitting around there. He sees this black and tan German shepherd lying there next to the campfire. So you say, do you think that if you look at a black and tan German shepherd lying there on the ground, Do you recognize there's a difference between the dog, the German Shepherd dog, and the black and tan of the dog? In other words, don't you think that you can have a dog that isn't black and tan? It might be another color. If you don't have black or tan, unless you're Plato, which is why I'm not a Platonist, you don't have those unless there's something that is black or tan. And I think most people go, yeah, it's got to be a thing that either is black or is red or whatever it is. Well, that is the substance accident distinction. Or today we would probably, instead of the word accident, most philosophers probably use the term property, attribute, or characteristic. So the distinction between the thing and its attributes or its properties, that distinction is a philosophical distinction. It's something you talk about in metaphysics. Not only that, you've already mentioned the dog was lying down. So there's a difference between lying down and the dog. You go, yeah. So not only is there a difference between lying down and the dog, you can have a dog that's not lying down, but you don't have a lying down that's not something lying down. So here's another substance acid distinction. But also, do you see the difference between the black and tan of the dog and the lying down of the dog? You go, yeah, they're not even like each other. They relate to the dog in different ways, right? And so as you follow that through, you reproduce what are known as the 10 categories in Aristotle, substance and the 9 attribute. But we're all inevitably engaging ourselves in reality, a deep analysis of which is due in philosophy. So, for example, if we walk outside on a clear day, sunny day, and I observe how beautiful the sun is, the sunshine. I'm not really doing astronomy, right? But I've observed a part of reality that a certain concerted effort to investigate is astronomy or astrophysics.
Gotcha.
And that's how I see the difference between just being a normal person, because I would argue a lot of this classical philosophy that we champion at the seminary just hooks right back in to what everybody sees, hears, tastes, touches, and smells as normal human beings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you made an interesting sense that I know in Platonic thought, Plato would argue that black and tan, that there are ideal forms of colors that exist independently somewhere of their actuality and coming into physical existence. And I think it was Augustine. It was Augustine that took Plato and ran with the idea of the ideal.
Yeah, I described it as Augustine, or however you pronounce it. I still used to tease it, said St. Augustine is in Florida. St. Augustine is in heaven. So, okay. Okay, so whatever.
Okay, there we go.
however it is. But yeah, I sort of characterize it as that Augustine took Plato and he baptized it and sanctified it for Christian thought. And Aquinas mm-hmm. took Aristotle and baptized it and sanctified it for Christian thought. So these four luminaries contribute a lot to what we identify as Western civilization today, in fact.
Yeah, that's really the two... Doric or Ionic, whatever columns you want to use, of the temple of Western thinking, when you have the Platonic, Augustinian, and the Aristotelian, Aquinas pillars of thought. And it seems like you could certainly make a case, a convincing case, for both ways of looking at things. But so I like the distinction. The simple everyday observations that we make, when you investigate them further and more analytically, we end up starting to really get to the heart of Aristotelian philosophy, just examining the physical world and the differences and their interactions with what we see with our senses.
Yeah, that's correct? My agenda. You know, I've teased the students. I try to get you to drink the Kool-Aid of Thomas Aquinas to the consternation of a lot of other conservative Protestant evangelicals.
Yeah, why are you advocating Catholic thought here, exactly. Dr. Howe? What are you doing to it? What are you doing to us, man? But in all practical reality, getting back to what we were mentioning earlier, this becomes, for a lot of people that aren't interested in it, this becomes quite difficult and uninteresting. But if we are going to be people who engage this non-Christian, this increasingly growing non-Christian worldview that we inhabit, whether it's other religions or non-religious people, atheist skeptics, whatever the case may be, that in this day and age, we as Christians are going to have to be more thoughtful about how we approach people who are not Christians.
Absolutely.
It's just with the information age and, you know, our global capacity to know what's going on in London and England and everywhere else that we need to know, what does our neighbor believe? Because our neighbor just flew in from Afghanistan and he's now a U.S. citizen and he believes in Islam. And, you know, well, my neighbor's a Jehovah's Witness or my neighbor's an atheist philosopher. It just seems like we have to be better thinkers.
Yeah.
Dr. Howe.
No, absolutely. And it's not that everybody has to know everything. It's that somebody has to know this. You know, one of my areas outside of philosophy that I've focused on over the decades is the occult and Satanism and witchcraft. Well, everybody doesn't have to run out and read a satanic Bible, but somebody needs to. Some Christian needs to. Not everybody has to read the Latter-day Saints material, but there's somebody needs to do that. And then those of us who don't do that need to know who to send them to if it gets to that level, right? And so whatever sphere of influence you put a person in, that might be the thing that they're more conversant in. And then they acquaint themselves. But go to Watchman Fellowship if you need information on this group, for example, and they know how to send people there. It's unfortunate, though, I think, at least in my experience, a lot of times the Christians don't do either. They neither have any kind of thing to contribute to the conversation, and they don't know anybody else either that has anything to contribute to the conversation. So when an opportunity presents itself to be salt and light, they've lost the flavor, and there's nothing for them to say. And I think that's, we're losing a lot of good opportunities to the degree that I'm intellectually lazy and don't want to really acquaint myself with stuff. I miss opportunities that God may bring my way.
Right. And it seems like, too, that bad philosophy, I know with your familiarity with the occult and certainly what we do at Watchmen, that bad philosophy is just a slippery slope into Gnosticism, which is a form of bad philosophy, but Gnosticism and then the occult. So it's just, I think it was Chesterton that said, you know, the having an open mind, you know, has within it the purpose of eventually closing it on something, because you don't want your brains to spill out. So we have to close it on good philosophy in order to prevent that slippery slide down into these false beliefs.
Absolutely.
The occultism and the appeal of Gnosticism is making a renowned comeback too, with all this secret knowledge. Even self-help literature has a kind of Gnostic philosophical mm-hmm. element to it. You know, yes. I'm going to give you this secret knowledge and you will be, you know, fill in the blank, happy, wealthy, and wise if you acquire the secret knowledge. So we, getting back to what you said earlier about Lewis, we need good philosophy in order to counter the bad philosophy that's out there. So let's kind of, for just real quick, step out of ancient Greece and Rome and get into sort of the modern 21st century, where we're still dealing with the fallout of Jean-François Lyotard and Jacques Derrida, these French philosophers who were suspicious that there could be any comprehensive meta-narrative or worldview, that yes. the texts can mean whatever you want them to mean. There is no big overarching teleological picture about the cosmos. Everything is just disconnected. And Lyotard was, his meta-narrative was incredulity, though, which is kind of funny, as far as I'm reading him correctly. But speak to that, because there seems to be a disenchantment with the idea that we can make a cohesive, cumulative case narrative out of the whole world. There seems to be so many disparate parts that comprise our world now, and all seems to be chaos and craziness and false, you know, fake news and everything. How can there be? Are the postmodernists onto something? Is there no way we can make sense of a meta-narrative? How do we bring philosophy into that? I know it's a big question.
It's bad philosophy, as you rightfully characterize it, is a threat at several levels, because it has infiltrated, if you will, biblical studies, so that now you've got greater or lesser degrees of a kind of a latent relativism with respect to biblical interpretation. My brother, Tom Howe, who's our Hebrew professor, and he does hermeneutics and philosophy of language and philosophy of hermeneutics at Southern Evangelical Seminary, his dissertation, which eventually was published in a book, and I don't get residuals for this, so I'm touting his wares here, but Objectivity and Biblical Interpretation. When Baxter wrote the foreword to it back in the late 90s, he said, in my 45 years of teaching, I've seen nothing like it. He was exposing this encroachment of this relativism, postmodern thinking. When he did his research in the late 90s in hermeneutics, and was looking at evangelical scholars who wrote on hermeneutics that fell into his purview as he's doing his research, out of about 40 writers, not people that use hermeneutics, but actually wrote it as a subject, about it as a subject matter, out of about 40 or so evangelical scholars, only two believed there was objective meaning that one could get out of the text.
Wow.
Yeah, that's startling.
That's incredible. I mean, that's right there. That is the direct influence of Jacques Derrida, right?
It absolutely is. In fact, that's what he does in his Objectivity and Biblical Interpretation. He traces and analyzes the philosophy of, like, the Derridas or the Foucaults or whomever that contribute in their own way to this mindset.
At the conclusion of Richard's brother Thomas Howe's book, Objectivity in Biblical Interpretation, Thomas observes that the postmodern belief that, quote, no particular framework of understanding is universally valid, end quote, is actually self-refuting. As he notes, quote, this very claim assumes its own universal validity. It is undeniably the case that there are aspects of every framework that are unavoidable, self-evident, and true, and the same for all frameworks, end quote. But it is the encroachment of this slipshod postmodern assumption that there are no universal narratives into modern biblical interpretation that must be of paramount concern for Christians who read, interpret, and rely upon the Bible for objective truth about creation, mankind, and the nature of God. As Thomas notes at the conclusion of the introductory chapter, quote, if everyone interprets the world through his or her own preconditional framework, then the possibility of adjudicating between frameworks seems to be impossible. Everyone would simply understand his opponent's framework in terms of his own, and any criticisms would be valid only within the framework of the particular interpreter. The rejection of objectivity seems to entail the loss of objective meaning, and the loss of objective meaning seems to entail the loss of objective truth, end quote. Without a standard of truth to adjudicate between the often contrary, conflicting, and ever-changing interpretive grids of individuals and societies, man is lost in a hopeless flux of meaningless, self-generated meaning. But Jesus declares to his disciples and to us that he is the way, the truth, and the life. We need both good philosophy and sound theology working hand in hand to counter the baleful impact of postmodern relativism.
So that's one area that is, which is the most startling to us as Christians. But then, irrespective of whether one is a Christian, just by virtue of being a human being, and more narrowly being an American, you also see the encroachment of this stuff in public policy and in culture. I'm reading right now Carl Truman's The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, where he, again, tries to trace and does a masterful job so far of tracing these philosophical influences. Talk about the need for philosophy. Talk about the bad philosophy needs to be answered. We're dealing with this woke nonsense, which is the fruit that's born on the vine that grew out of a seed planted centuries ago in philosophy departments that nobody cared about except egghead, ivory tower philosophers. And now it's trickled down, and the rot now is just seeping through all of culture. So now you can have an adult actually think, an adult man actually think he's a woman, actually thinks he could be a woman. You go, that just didn't pop out of nowhere. It may look that because it was a pretty fast one at the level of pop culture. But if you look at the influences that give rise to that stuff, it's not new. It's been
in the soil for a long time.
It absolutely has. And we've been sort of marinating in it for a long time. And now finally the stench gets strong enough that everybody that hates it can smell it. And others celebrate it because they're part of the problem. And a lot of it is this relativism. It's just a form of relativism that comes out of this postmodern thinking that when you come to a text, to talk about it in terms of text, when you come to a text, you bring your own life experiences. And so the meaning of the text and the meaning that you bring to it from your life experiences merge, and you construct a truth. And that's your truth, you know. I remember Bart Ehrman was, just to finish this anecdote, Bart Ehrman was on our campus at Southern Evangelical Seminary for a debate. During the Q&A, my brother Tom asked him about his comment that when you read a text, you actually change the text because you bring, he asked him, he said, well, how am I going to understand your book that you wrote? If I'm reading your book, how am I going to know what you're trying to tell me? Because I'm changing the meaning. And Ehrman said, well, that's an important question. It's maybe a little too much for us to get into here. Perhaps I can email you on it. And Tom said, how am I going to understand your email? And the whole audience guffaw. And I guarantee you, Bart Ehrman didn't know what people were laughing about.
Right.
But most of the people in our audience, most of them were students and friends of the seminary, were keen on this self-refuting nature of the postmodern.
Yeah. Well, as I even read snippets of Derrida, I'm wondering, you know, Jacques, I don't think you would appreciate people misunderstanding what you mean. Can I just interpret your interpretation however I want? Or do you mean to have intentionality behind your words about what constitutes the reality of texts?
Yeah, no.
I mean, it is self-refuting on so many levels.
It absolutely is.
I do want to wrap back to the question that we started with in our conversation and have you tie together, because we've sort of been dancing around it. But this idea that that philosophy and theology are handmaidens, or they go together, or one needs the other. Mm-hmm. We never really traded on a definition of theology in terms of how philosophy and theology are integrated. So maybe we can end there, and you can kind of wrap up about the practical and philosophical implications of theology and philosophy being working together hand in hand.
Yeah. So one of the things that I use as an illustration to try to sell my audience on the need of philosophy is take a passage like Genesis chapter 3. I was talking to a friend of mine in my church. I was just using him as a sounding board. I think we probably pretty much thought the same about these fundamental questions. And I said, you know, Genesis 3, it talks about God walking in the garden. Adam and Eve heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden. It's not a theophany. It doesn't fit the literary structure of theophany. And even if it was a theophany, I would pick one on a whole array of other verses to make the point I'm about to make.
Mm-hmm.
I asked my friend, I said, so do you believe God has legs? He said, no, I don't believe God has legs. Well, he's walking in the garden. You can't walk without legs. Snakes don't have legs. They don't walk. I said, why don't you believe God has legs? He said, because I believe God's a spirit. John chapter 4, Jesus said, God is spirit. I said, so what do you do with the Genesis 3 passage? He said, well, I take it as a figure of speech. And I asked him, I said, well, how do you know the John 4 passage isn't the figure of speech? That is, without argument, you just assume, well, God's figuratively walking around. He's literally a spirit. How do you know he isn't figuratively a spirit and he's literally walking around or some other way to manage
the ground? Yeah.
In other words, what is it? And you could give, if you look at the Dake Annotated Reference Bible, which I'm sure you and your staff are very familiar with as cult experts, where you could get just numerous verses that describe God always in the categories of the finite physical world. Mm-hmm. In terms of walking around. 2 Samuel 7, God is saying, hey, when are you going to build me a house to dwell in? I've been moving in this tent all these years. And you go, wait a minute, I thought you were omnipresent. How could you be moving around in a tent? That doesn't make sense. So you have all these descriptions of that. And my argument is, by parallel of the way we would do with the physical world, let me put a comma there. Isaiah 55 says that the trees will clap their hands. Now, we know that that's a figure of speech. We know that's a metaphor. But the only reason we know it is we know what a tree is, literally. And we know that trees don't literally have hands. They only poetically have hands. Mm. But when Isaiah says in Isaiah 55, the trees will clap their hands, we know it's speaking poetically. But how do we know that trees don't have hands? Well, we know trees don't have hands because we've had enough experience with trees over our life as a human being that our intellect is able to understand what the nature of a tree is sufficiently to know when people give it characteristics like hands, it's not really literally true. So I think the argument has to be then, by parallel, there must be some way we could know enough about the nature of God so that when the scriptures speak figuratively about him, versus properly about him, we know which one's the figure of speech and which one's not. The problem is we can't know God the way we know a tree. We don't walk out and look at him and say, well, sure enough, he doesn't have legs. And then now that's what Dake might do, although he thinks he does have legs in his annotated reference Bible. But other than that cultic kind of thing, we would say we don't do that. So what do? I think the key there is Romans chapter 1, where Paul talked about the invisible attributes of God are clearly seen, being understood through the things that are made. And what I teach my students about is, I think Paul is basically telling us, starting with what you see, hear, taste, touch, or smell, you can demonstrate the existence of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob with all of these superlative attributes that we shared, omnipotent, omniscient, all good, all powerful, all wise, all of that, except the Trinity, I don't think he can, but all of this to be the God of classical theism. Now, let me just add one point. When I used to give this example, Simon Brace, who used to be on our staff, who's now the director of Ratio Christi in South Africa, he said, you know, you don't need to use the Dake Annotated Reference Bible as an illustration because most people are just going to see that it's so wacky, cultic, that they're, well, I'm not in danger of that. He said, what you need to do is use Gregory Boyd as an example. Because then that hits closer to home. Well, how is he an example of the same philosophical problem? Well, Gregory Boyd, who is a member, at least the last time I checked, of the Evangelical Theological Society, he's a well-respected Christian. I don't doubt his integrity as a Christian and his piety and his love for God. But he's adamant that God cannot know and does not know the future actions of free creatures. God cannot know what you're freely going to choose for lunch tomorrow. Mm. All right. And he uses Bible verses to give that same argument. So I'm going, well, I think it's the same problem. You could use the Bible to show God has physical characteristics. You can show that he's finite. You can show that he changes his mind, that he doesn't know certain things. And so either those are literally true about God, which means I think we've made God a creature, or they're not true literally, but in some other sense, in which case one would have to use the tools of sound philosophy to show how it is that we can know God is omniscient and does know the future and that he is timeless and stuff. Mm. Now, some of these things get into issues that are contentious even among evangelical Christians. And I understand that. I'm willing to make my arguments and allow my brothers and sisters in Christ the liberty to make their different conclusions based on their argument. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But at least the principle is the arguments are going to at some point inevitably be philosophical. And it's going to call from 2,400 plus years of philosophical history to try to make our cases to show how we can demonstrate the God of the classical theists, of all of these Omnes, or the god of more contemporary theism, where he doesn't maybe know the future, or he is a temporal being, and that kind of stuff. Anyway, that's the stakes, I think, in the debate about the legitimacy and role that philosophy might play in helping.
Gotcha. Well, and from a biblical perspective, as I'm listening to you, I think I can somewhat make sense of the idea that the etymology of philosophy is love and wisdom, a love of wisdom. And of course, the Bible has a lot to say about wisdom, both in the Hebrew and the Greek, in terms of Psalm 111:10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Job 28, the magisterial passage about where can wisdom be found. Proverbs 8, the personification of wisdom. And of course, in John, 1 John, God is love. So in a sense, I see, and though I'm not a philosopher, I see the theological, the study of God, and the philosophy being one and the same in some sense of the fact that it is all pointing back to the Logos himself, to Christ. And so and this is what I appreciate about John Frame, is that all philosophical discourse should lead, from a Christian perspective, should lead us to the person of Christ. Because as you're talking about God walking in the garden, I'm thinking of Jesus with the disciples, and they ask him, "Show us the Father." And Jesus says that enigmatic statement, "I and the Father, I've been with you so long, Philip," and you say, "Show us the Father," and this idea of God as a father is not like Mormons believe. He has a perfected physical body like a dad in a physical life, but that the invisible attributes of fatherhood are what characterize God, that we can see that God is like a father in the paternal sense of how he cares for creation. And there's all kinds of scripture that talks about God's care of creation. It's not that God is up there with a physical fatherly body, as Mormons believe, but that the invisible attributes of fatherhood can be clearly seen in how God cares for his creation. And that's kind of how I see, so walking in the garden is the similar sense of how do you hear a non-physical being communicating with us is really the issue. How does he come to us? How does he speak to us? And so in anthropomorphic language, in the context of his invisible attributes, is what God is communicating to us because of, in that same passage in Isaiah, Isaiah 55, along with the clapping of the hands of the trees, is that verse about my thoughts are not your thoughts.
That's right.
As far as the heavens are above the earth, so are my thoughts over your thoughts in that sense. So on the one hand, God is intimately knowable through what he has made, but on the other hand, he remains transcendently other from human beings. It doesn't mean we can't know him. It just means that we can only know him in the way that he has revealed himself through creation.
That's right. Exactly. So, and the celebration of God's revelation of himself through creation is a lot of what my philosophical ministry, if you will, is on.
Well, and it makes sense.
Natural theology.
Right, right. And based on how you've explained it, Richard, I can fully understand why you're an Aristotelian. You espouse to the that side of things because you are looking at physical creation and deriving mm-hmm. God's invisible attributes from what you are looking at. So the black and tan.
And I insist on the bow on the package that Thomas Aquinas brings to the conversation.
Yeah, there you go.
His contributions to Aristotle.
Absolutely. I have started several times to read Aquinas, and I get maybe 100 pages into it. I'm like, I'm never going to finish this thing. Probably because
it's heavy going. I mean, it's just a lot of literature as we go back to the Middle Ages back is I think challenging. At least it is for me. Secondary sources are incredibly indispensable, I think, in wrapping our minds around some of these thinkers.
Okay. As we close here, Richard, can you give our lay philosophically minded audience who might be interested in delving into this some entry level resources or a book or two, a good place to begin. If you want a broader perspective, is there a good all-in-one resource that you might recommend or number of resources, whatever you want to
do? There are so many that come to mind, but some that come more quickly to mind than others, perhaps. I mentioned already my brother Tom Howe's book, Objectivity and Biblical Interpretation, which I think is a great foray into the questions of biblical hermeneutics. So that, I think, is what makes it such a practical value. I love Edward Faser's little beginner's guide book titled Thomas Aquinas, or I think it's just called Aquinas. It's just something you could sit down in one reading and just get the bird's eye view. Norm Geisler's book, Thomas Aquinas and Evangelical Appraisal, and I've been talking with the Norman Geisler National Ministries and Bastion Books. Geisler actually did a third edition of that hasn't been published yet. So they're quickly trying to get it all ready for publication. So keep the ear to the ground about that. I think that's a great read. So because it addresses what it is about Aquinas that endures irrespective of the Protestant Catholic divide, because a lot of early Protestants were very much steeped in this classical tradition, including some to a greater extent than others. But the critics today make it sound like that Aquinas is Catholic. You go, no, the thinking of this philosophical tradition that comes out of the ancient Greeks flourished in Protestantism, and you can see it. That's a subject for another broadcast, perhaps, but it's there. So Fazer's Aquinas book, or Tom Howe's Objectivity and Biblical Interpretation, Norm Geisler's Thomas Aquinas and Evangelical Appraisal, I think there's some good
stars. And Fazer has a good book, Five Proofs, or I think it's
Five
called.
Proofs, yes.
Yeah, that's
specifically
pretty good.
On the existence of God. Yes.
Right, that's a great book. I know a lot of Protestants. I remember my initial introduction into who Aquinas was because I had, as a new Christian, I was about a Christian about 5 years, and I had a pastor give a sermon about Aquinas, and it was a mention that the quote at the end or towards the end of the book where Aquinas gave up on his writing because he had an experience that made him say that everything that he had written up until that point was straw.
That's right.
And
that
seems to be, the Protestants, if you want to read Aquinas, read that last quote there, and it's all straw.
I deal with that actually in my dissertation. I did my dissertation on Aquinas, and that's often just sort of wrenched out of context. I think it doesn't mean what people wished it meant. Like Aquinas. He wasn't repudiating. He was using an agrarian metaphor to make a point about the relationship of what we can know about God in this life versus what we can know about God in the next life.
Yeah.
Is the point that I think he's trying to make.
Gotcha.
Which I think all of us would acknowledge. Yeah, this side of heaven, there's, you know, we're still in our sinful bodies, and you know, there's still limits, and someday we will see him as he is, as 1 John says.
Okay.
So that's what he was trying to illustrate by that agrarian metaphor of this wheat, kernel of the wheat and the husk.
Right.
Most of the apologetics are the, you know, the atheism, theism kind of stuff, evolution, science and stuff. The cults and the occult are sometimes overlooked too much, and their threat hasn't lessened it.
Right. You know, I'd argued with, we were talking about, you know, the LGBTQ agenda, and I was talking to somebody about this, and I said, well, you know, there's 3 million people in Utah, just to the north of us, who believe something aberrant and build temples toward it. 16 million people believe this and are wholly committed to this idea that is completely antithetically anti-biblical. Mormons get their door slammed in their face, and every slammed door in the face of a Mormon is the advance of Joseph Smith's kingdom.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. In fact, it's funny. I've just been listening to, I'm not sure how they populated. I know after I looked at the first one, the rest of them populated. I'm not sure how the first one got on. These Mormon apologists giving testimonies and giving their sort of basic apologetics. And I've been listening because it's been a long time since I've done. It used to be my focus before it became the occult with Mormonism, but I've forgotten so much about it. You know,
with LDS, Richard, I'll tell you one thing that's very helpful is really being familiar with good epistemological argumentation. Before you even get into their doctrines, you can have a rich philosophical discussion about how we know what we know, because their go-to is the burning in the bosom, the feeling.
Absolutely. Their testimony.
Testimony, that they'll bear their testimony in the face of logic and logical contradictions and historical information that counters what Smith claims. But if you can get into an epistemological discussion about their testimony and the possibility that that testimony might be in error, then you can begin to have those meaningful dialogues about
I did just most recently. I had a pair of Mormons come to my door, and we got into a conversation, and it eventually finds its way to that, you know, hey, read Moroni 10, read, pray about it, ask God. And I told him, I said, well, I asked God, and he told me Joseph Smith was a false prophet. And so we started kind of going down that, and it got more and more where I was being more and more confrontational, to challenge them. And one of the two missionaries at my door, he just turned around and walked away.
Yep. Yep.
You know, the other one, of course, is trying to kind of, you know, tamp things down a little bit. He was a more experienced one. But right. I finally said, I can't get Latter-day Saint to talk with me about this stuff. It ends up like this, walking away. I was trying to bait him into, you're always like a man. But it didn't work. They never come back.
they don't. And James's approach, he does often say that. It's interesting, though. So you're saying, because James will say, he'll pray the prayer and mention that same thing that you've mentioned. And he'll say, well, so then it's possible. Then they will tell him that's a deception of Satan. So James's conclusion is, so then I can pray, someone can pray this prayer, and it's possible that Satan might be deceiving you. And that is a very helpful gateway into more fruitful conversations. But most people are unfamiliar with Mormonism and Mormons and Mormon missionaries and Mormon doctrine to not really be able to negotiate the way in which you can have these meaningful dialogues with them. So philosophy there, in talking to LDS or Jehovah's Witnesses or Muslims, the philosophy definitely comes in handy. It's not just excellent. Something.
I'm glad you guys are on the front line like you are.
Oh, yeah. We've had Paul Gould, Jamie Dew. We've had Esther Lightcap Meek. We've had Graham Oppie. We've tried to have a rich philosophical integration into our apologetics on our podcast and stuff. And so it's always absolutely nice to talk.
Well, I'm just honored to be a small part of it. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're great, Richard. We love having you. We love talking to you. Looking forward to some dinners at Defend with you in January.
Absolutely.
And have a wonderful autumnal restful season. I know it's teaching for you, but it's
it's fun.
It's fun. Yeah. You enjoy it. You're good at what you do. You're an exciting, knowledgeable teacher that makes the craft very interesting.
Well,
you're
kind.
Do you have a book? Have you written a book yet?
I've co-written a book, and then I've got chapters in lots of books, but I've never written a book.
Okay.
I've read a book, however. That's a start.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I've co-authored myself.
Norm Geiser wrote Religion of the Force back in the, umpteen. In the,
Star Wars?
83. Yeah, no, Star Wars. Uh-huh. I did from that in my own research over the years. I put together a presentation on by that title, "Religion of the Force" or whatever, and it was full of movie clips. That's what was so fun about it, is I went through and just showed the where the religion of the Jedi comported with Christianity and where it contrasted, and go all the way through. So it was fun to do because we're watching all these clips. Well, finally, just sort of the novelty sort of wore off when it started coming back with the, I guess it was the Force Awakens, when that was all being hyped up after Disney was going to buy everything. I was having lunch with Geiser once, and he said, "Hey, you want to help me? We'll revisit this book. You can be my co-author." I said, "Sure." So basically, I wrote out the stuff that I did in my PowerPoint presentation. I just wrote all that out and wove it in to the previous material, and it got re-released, second edition, so to speak. So that's pretty fun.
All right. Tell our listeners real quick here and ways that they can find out. You've got a presence on the internet. Where can people go?
Yeah. So here's a way you can do that is richardghowe.com. Don't leave out the G. It stands for good looking.
Richard G. For good looking, Richard G. Howe with an E on the end of Howe, richardghowe.com. Yes. A wealth of resources for a wonderfully adroit communicator of philosophical concepts. Get to know
it's a,
Richard.
It's a kind of cheesy website. I'm not a web developer, but I think most of the links work.
Well, you have to be. You know, I've noticed that people that are really smart in one area, you know, tend to be kind of quirky and funny in another
exactly.
area.
Yeah.
You know, so that's allowable. We'll go ahead and.
That's right. It's all about the kingdom for me, so I don't really worry about.
That's right. That's right. You don't care what PowerPoints look like, and you know. Certain things like this. So, visit richardghowe.com, a quirky website for people wanting to know more about philosophy and a fun way to communicate it. Richard, it's been a wonderful 90 minutes with you. Thank you for being with us on Apologetics Profile, sir.
Thanks, Daniel. God bless.